From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Humans write. We compose blogs. We scribble in journals. We pen screenplays in the wee hours after a tedious day job. We write books on anything and everything, and we search for a publisher. Writing is so pervasive. And yet, as George Orwell famously wrote, writing a book is a horrible, exhausting struggle, like a long bout of some painful illness. So why do we do it? In a recent New York Times piece, the author Steve Almond argues writing has replaced the therapist's couch. Whether or not the prose is tight and the sentence structure coherent, writing, he says, is cathartic. Today on the program, we're exploring why we write and how to get better at it. Plus, an insider's guide to the Salt Lake City Cemetery. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Writing, it's a creative process, a craft dominated by words and punctuation and themes and characters. Writers are motivated by storytelling, saying something profound and illuminating the human condition, right? Well, the writer Steve Almond argues writers write to purge their own souls, to explore personal weakness, and to find truth about themselves. In short, writing, he says, is therapy. Today on the program, we're talking about why we write and the ins and outs of the writing process. Joining us this hour is Steve Almond. He's the author of 10 books, including Candy Freak and God Bless America. His article, Why Therapy is on the Wane and Writing Workshops are on the Rise, it was published in the March 23rd edition of the New York Times Magazine. And Steve Almond is joining us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. And Steve, thanks so much for your time.
Good to be here.
Also with us, David Tippetts. He is a memoir and fiction writer, and he chairs the Writers Critique Group at the Salt Lake City Library. He's a board member of Writers at Work. David is joining me in studio. David, welcome.
Thank you.
Steve Almond and others will present writing workshops at the Writers at Work Conference, which will be held at the Alta Lodge from June 6th through June 10th. And there's more information on our website. We'll give you more on that as we go. Later on in the program, the final resting place for prophets, politicians, and pioneers. We give you a guide to the Salt Lake City Cemetery. But first, writing. Are you blogging or working on the great American novel? What keeps you motivated as a writer? And what do you know about becoming a better writer? You can give us a call if you like. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Steve Almond, your thesis in this piece, this New York Times piece, is that, you know, people are turning to writing workshops not to tell some kind of truth about the human condition, but more as some sort of self-medication. And you use your own experience as supporting evidence. Briefly, tell us why you decided to become a writer.
Well, I was a journalist for, you know, 6 or 7 years, and I enjoyed doing it, although I don't think I was very good at it. But I just got bored of the sorts of questions that were being asked, which were, you know, sort of who did what wrong and here's the proof. They were external questions. They didn't have to do with what was going on inside of the people that I was writing about. Those questions, why do we push away success? Why do we, you know, blow it up when we start to enjoy some prosperity? Why do people disappoint us? Why do we disappoint ourselves? Why can't we hold on to love? All those big questions with the big question marks at the end are literary questions. The piece I wrote for the Times was not arguing that writing is therapy. It was arguing that writing is therapeutic because it is our effort to answer some of those questions and tell the story that, or the stories, I should say, that live inside of us, as opposed to, you know, journalism, for instance, which, even though it can be wonderful, it's generally dedicated straight journalism, not long-form narrative journalism, but straight journalism of the sort I was doing was really fact-gathering. Hmm.
You see a real connection between the rise of writing workshops and the wane of talk therapy. When did you see this connection? And, you know, why do you think these two are linked in some way?
Well, the reason I see them as linked is probably because of my own mishigas. I mean, I'm the kid of two therapists who essentially, you know, and I've done my share of therapy. But I started thinking about that process and thinking, well, what is a good therapist doing? They're listening to stories and they're trying to figure out what's going on inside of people, things they can't even see or understand. through the stories that they're telling, some of which might be random or avoidant, but ultimately the goal in a therapeutic setting is to get to the bottom of it. Whatever the primal scene is, the moments or the dynamics that are still haunting that person and keeping them from moving forward and having a greater sense of self-understanding and not beating themselves up. Mm. And I see writing as asking that same set of questions. And as I travel around teaching at places like Writers at Work, or teaching students here at Grub Street in Boston, I was kind of thinking about, so what do these people really want? Well, maybe some of them want to be famous or they want to have a narcissistic reward and get their name out there. But I think at the bottom of it, Jennifer, what they want is to find a truer, braver version of themselves, to start to get real about what's going on inside them and the, you know, the relationships in their lives. And I don't see that as a I'm not saying that, you know, so our job in the writing workshop is to pat them on the back and make them feel better. That's not it at all. Our job is actually to make them feel brave enough to get into the darkest stuff and to not turn away and run away when the feelings become overwhelming. Because that's what makes great literature, is when characters are overrun by the emotions that we all recognize. And in other parts of our lives, we're constantly being marketed to and sort of being told you can cure your problems with the right product. But I think deep down, we know that's nonsense, that the only way you really make any sort of progress is by facing your demons. And that the best way that we can do that is by making art, whether it's visual art or musical art or, in my case, literary art.
Hmm. We're speaking with the author Steve Almond, also with us David Tippetts with Writers at Work. David, does this argument that Almond is making resonate with you? Is this something that you have seen in the workshops that you've conducted, people looking for that therapeutic salve that writing can provide?
Yes, of course. It's mixed, but you see that over and over again. In the little workshop that I do here at the library, we have people who come and go on a constant basis. They'll come to the workshop every for a few weeks or a few months, and then they go, and they've found something that they wanted. They've discovered something they wanted or not, and we see people come to the writer's workshop, and it's obvious they're working out their problems. And sometimes it gets in the way of the writing because it's too emotional, and they're too close to it, and they can't be objective. And the writers who really want to get to that point of objectivity where they can stand back and look at themselves are the ones that will make it as writers. Whether they ever make the kind of success that Steve Almond has is another question. But for most people, I don't think that's the goal. Or it shouldn't be. They want one thing, is that they want the status. They want to be able to tell their friends that they've published writing. And the first product, the first publication I had was in Montana Magazine. And it was a piece about something that happened in my youth when I was 20 years old up in Montana. And I was so proud of it. And we happened to be driving through Montana when it came out, and it was on the cover, on the front of every convenience store we went in. It was right in the front, and I picked it up. I was so proud of it, and I handed it across the desk. I was going to buy another copy, and I told the clerk, I published this, and I was so proud of it. And she looked up at me and she said, "That'll be $6.95, sir."
There it is. That's fame in the literary world.
There it is. David Tippetts. He's with Writers at Work. Also, the author, Steve Almond, is with us, author of Candy Freak, God Bless America, and many other books. His piece in the New York Times, Why Therapy is on the Wane and Writing Workshops are on the Rise. He'll be speaking at the 27th annual Writers at Work conference happening June 6th through 10th at the Alta Lodge here in Alta, Utah. Give us a call if you'd like to join us with your writing stories. What motivates you as a writer? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Steve Almond, the author George Orwell, penned a very prominent essay entitled Why I Write. And the first among the reasons why he says people write is what David Tippetts was describing, sheer egoism. Did you have that thrill, that adrenaline rush when you saw your name in print for the first time?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's probably the reason I got into journalism, because that's the quickest way to get your work in front of the world. And I think that every writer, you know, internally there's a struggle. I mean, every person, there's a struggle within everybody for recognition and acclaim and narcissistic reward. And then at a deeper level, for a feeling that somebody really understands you, and that you're able to allow some of the, at least in literary art, allow some of the ugly, shameful, you know, unbearable stuff onto the page. I think I know the piece that David is talking about. Do I, Dave? Have I seen that piece?
Yeah, you have.
Okay, so you know what was beautiful about that piece of writing, and I was lucky enough to, I think, see it in an early draft, was here was this guy, I didn't know him from Adam, writing this absolutely heart-rending, beautiful recollection of a memory that had haunted him for, you know, decades, and getting to the truth of that moment in his life where everything changed. And that's the kind of, I agree with Orwell. I'm not going to be dumb enough to disagree with him. We're all driven by narcissism and egotism and wanting to kind of have the status and get our names out there. But I think underneath that, we're driven by something deeper than that, which is the desire to be known. That's why these communities of writers are so powerful to people. You know, it's not going to happen on the internet just by updating your Facebook page. That might be the narcissistic impulse, but it isn't going to give you the real sense of reward, which is somebody, you know, you unburdening yourself and sharing a part of yourself that you had kept hidden, and somebody, you know, not turning around and screaming in horror, but in fact saying, yep, I understand that. I've been there too. Thank you for being brave enough to put it out there.
Steve Almond is the author of Candy Freak, God Bless America, and many other books, and he's presenting at this year's Writers at Work Conference, June 6th through June 10th here in Alta, Utah. David Tippetts is a board member of Writers at Work, and we're talking about the art and the craft of writing and what motivates people to put pen to paper. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and Chris is joining us from Salt Lake City. Chris, hi.
Hi there, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, it's really interesting to hear everything that the guests are saying. I direct the Writing Center at Westminster College, and I'm just curious how they see what they're talking about, the sort of therapeutic benefit, the self-expressive benefit of writing, relating to all the other kinds of writing that we do. Because certainly creative writing is important, but not all of us are novelists, not all of us are poets. What about all that other kind of writing we do on a day-to-day basis?
Interesting question. Chris, you know, we blog, we write in our journals. Are you limiting your argument, Steve Almond, to the creative writing? And how does non-creative writing fit into this?
Well, I don't know if there is anything known as non-creative writing. In other words, anybody who's trying to work with the language, you know, they might have a different intention. People whose job it is or who support themselves by writing, I don't know, pamphlets for, you know, a travel agency. I guess those don't exist anymore, but indulge me. You know, they have a particular, or here's an even funnier example. I had a friend whose job it was to provide the plot summaries for pornographic films. Now, I am not going to argue to you, Jennifer. Yeah, I know. I thought it would be a dream job, but he actually described it as a nightmare, as you can imagine. But yeah, I'm not going to argue that this guy was sitting there saying, now let me get into the heart of each of these characters, divine their motivations, their darkest secrets, and include that in this 150-word summation of, you know, whatever, Romancing the Bone or whatever it is. You know, he was doing something more practical with the language. But the fact of the matter is that good writing is writing that's lucid, that's clear, in which the reader understands, you know, what they're reading. The syntax is all in place, and these are things that are common to any form of writing that you undertake. So creative writing is trying to answer those internal questions, but I do all kinds of writing. I write about politics. I write editorials of various sorts. I write profiles of musicians. When I was a journalist, I was doing the same basic work, which was organizing the language so as to convey characters and scenes and get across basic facts to people.
But maybe I think what Chris is getting to, I mean, is that therapeutic? Is you know, any writing therapeutic?
Well, for me, it's not as deeply therapeutic. What I get from those assignments is a little sense of accomplishment and maybe a paycheck that allows me to spend some time supporting my bad habit, which is writing, you know, about the sort of inner turmoil of what I experience inside myself and my characters. So there is a difference, and I'm not trying to level it out and say it's all the same stuff. Obviously, if you have a commercial intent with your writing, you know, you're trying to get somebody to be drawn to a particular product or service or whatever it is. But what I am suggesting is studying writing, there is a reward. Anytime you successfully complete a piece of writing and deploy the language in the way that you want to meet your suited end, your stated end, that to me feels gratifying. Therapeutic may be overstating it, but gratifying certainly.
David Tibbetts?
Yes.
Things to add to those comments?
Yeah, it's I think creative writing puts you in a different state of mind. At least that's my experience. And it's hard to stay there, and it's hard to get there. And when I'm in the state that I aspire to, I start to dream in text, and I'm dreaming and I can almost see the language, and it's a very different place. So
that's right. That's right. My friend who was writing the, you know, porn synopsis is, I don't think he was dreaming in text.
No.
Might have been doing something in text, but it wasn't dreaming.
We're speaking with Steve Almond. He's the author of many books, including Candy Freak, God Bless America. His article, Why Therapy is on the Wane and Writing Workshops are on the Rise, was recently published in the New York Times Magazine. And he's one of the presenters at this year's 27th Annual Writers at Work Conference, happening June 6th through the 10th at the Alta Lodge here in Alta, Utah. There's more information on the website writersatwork.org. We will have links to both Steve Almond's article in the Times as well as to the conference on our website, kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but if you've got questions about becoming a better writer or comments on why you write, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about writing and the motivation behind composing books or penning screenplays or even scribbling in a journal. The author, Steve Almond, argues we write because it's therapeutic, it makes us feel better, and we'll have links to his New York Times piece, Why Talk Therapy is on the Wane and Writing Workshops are on the Rise, on our website, kcpw.org. He is presenting at the annual Writers at Work Conference being held June 6th through June 10th at the Alta Lodge. We'll give you more detail on that as we go. Also in studio with us, David Tibbetts. He's a board member of Writers at Work. And you can join our conversation if you like. If you blog or you're working on a novel, why do you write? Do you think it's purely instinctive to tell stories, or do you think writing is a way to purge your soul? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Steve Almond, is this a lot of navel gazing, or is there some practical reason, practical purpose to asking ourselves the question why we write?
Well, certainly it's navel gazing. That's our, you know, we live in that age. But, you know, I also feel like it's no coincidence that people are turning to the ancient pleasures of storytelling now in greater numbers than ever. And I see that because, you know, when I applied to get a Master's of Fine Arts, which is sort of writing school, and it was almost 20 years ago, there are about 30 programs, maybe 35 programs in the whole country. Now there are over 1,000 programs, undergraduate and graduate, that award a creative writing degree. So empirically, it has become much more common for people, civilians, to say to themselves, for whatever set of complicated reasons, I want to work with the language to tell stories. And I think the reason is because the world we live in has become frantic, morally chaotic. We're constantly sort of inundated with information and immerse ourselves in surfing around the internet or whatever screens we're looking at, or iPhones. And those things are a kind of frantic pursuit of emotional connection, right? We all want to be on the network. We all want to be experiencing the same story, whether it's OJ or Monica Lewinsky. But I don't think those sorts of stories, although they do kind of provoke our internal lives, are really the same as telling our own story and trying to understand why particular moments in our lives infect us, obsess us. And so I guess you could say it's navel gazing, but to make art requires self-examination, not self-indulgence, but really rigorous self-examination. That's what David was talking about when he talked about getting perspective or being objective. I'm not arguing that writing should make people feel better and they should just do a journal entry and suddenly they're a writer. In fact, my experience, Jennifer, is that writing about painful experiences, and I think David will back this up, is actually a very difficult thing to do. It's actually very destabilizing to experience things, you know, as they come up either in your memory or in the life of your characters, that are usually triggered by very painful memories that you have and dynamics. And I remember talking with a young woman. She'd written an essay about kind of her hair and how difficult it was to style her hair and how her parents were obsessed with it. And I said to her as I was reading, she meant it to be funny, and I said to her as she was, you know, reading over a passage that had to do with how it took 6 hours for her to comb out her hair and had to use all these chemicals to get it straight. And I looked at her and I said, gee, it sounds like there was a lot of pressure on you to be perfect when you were a kid. And she burst into tears. I don't think she was, you know, writing to make things easier. I think she was trying to tell strangers, tell me, tell the world, there was a lot of pressure on me as a kid. And it, you know, she was telling that story through the story of her hair. But you know, I can hear my peers cringing. Is Almond saying that writing is palliative and it should make us all feel better, and you know, that we should just publish our journals and call ourselves writers? It's not what I'm saying at all. But I am saying that human beings find meaning in storytelling, and the particular stories we tell are universal. You know, when we read about Achilles and Hector, we're reading about courage and cowardice, and those resonate within us because we're all human beings. We're all carrying around the same sacred fears and desires.
Mm. You mentioned the internet, and I'm interested in your thoughts on how you think the internet has changed the writer's craft, or has it?
Well, I think it's just a machine that has allowed us to distract ourselves and to move from the world, the actual physical world through which we used to move and, you know, observe what was around us, to a kind of suddenly the world is, or a million different worlds are on a little screen, and we can scroll around and surf from one place to another, from one narrative to another. So I think it's essentially enabled us to become distracted from what's really happening inside us. But the reason, therefore, Jennifer, that I think people are going back to writing workshops is because what they really want is what I talked about before and what David was talking about. They want to be known. They want to make the insides of themselves, even and especially the unbearable, ugly parts of themselves, known to the world, the parts of themselves that feel freakish or monstrous. And that really doesn't happen on the internet. If you've spent any time on the internet, you know that the meanest place on earth is the comment section of any particular artist. And whenever anybody lays themselves bare and really tells the truth, boy, they really let themselves in for abuse.
Do you read the comments, Steve Almond?
Of course, everyone does. Jennifer, everyone reads the comments. That's what they do. But a writing workshop, I think, in the best instance, certainly the sort that are writers at work, is just the opposite kind of experience. You come into the room and everybody says, okay, our job is to help everybody in here be more truthful and more eloquent about the truth.
Mm. David Tippetts.
Yeah, it really is. But there's another thing about, especially my experience in writing. I was raised in a 19th century household where we lived a very different lifestyle than is common today. And my concern is to preserve the stories and the circumstances of my upbringing. I didn't come to writing until I was 60 years old, and I was retired, this became my retirement. And so it's been a wonderful experience. But when I look at my motivation, I have a daughter who is in her 20s, and she asked me, why don't you write about us? Mm. And I said, well, you know, everybody has something in their past that bothers them, that intrigues them, that they're trying to work out. And it's those stories of my upbringing, the years on this farm in Montana, that is really my emotional center and where I want to preserve those stories.
Mm. The author, Terry Tempest Williams, she was asked, you know, why do I write? And her response was, it was quite wide-ranging, I have to say. She said, I write to make peace with things I cannot control. I write to create fabric in a world that often appears black and white. I write to discover. I thought some of those were just really beautiful sentiments, trying to explain the many reasons people come to language and use that as a refuge. Steve Almond?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you know, I wouldn't choose, and there's also, I sort of oftentimes run up against the argument of like, well, do you have to be damaged to write, you know? Do you have to be in inner turmoil to write? And I said, well, no, of course not. In fact, when you're depressed or, you know, if you're feeling too disoriented to put a sentence together, you're not going to do effective writing. There's this myth of the suffering artist, you know, the romantic myth of Byron and Shelley and, you know, Van Gogh and so forth. I say, look, I would not want to be Vincent Van Gogh, you know, even if I could look up into the night sky above Arles and see the starry, starry night, the stars exploding. I would not choose to be that anguished. But I do think that within all of us is a place, as Terry Tempest Williams is talking about, where we feel confused and muddled in a state of bewilderment and fear, and writing helps make sense of that. Dave is absolutely right that part of what we're trying to do is just get some perspective on who we are and what we've experienced. And some of that is simple preservation, because that work is not happening on the internet, and it doesn't happen. Art arises from concerted attention. It's an act of concerted attention. It is the antithesis of distraction, and I think that's really what's happening mostly, not entirely, but mostly on the internet. It's a culture that's very lonely and very afraid, trying to distract itself.
Terry Tempest Williams continues, I write to begin a dialogue, and I'm wondering, Steve Almond, if you enter your writing experience thinking about the reader, thinking about the audience and the reaction you might get to the words that you put on the page.
Well, every writer struggles with that to some extent, because as David knows, you know, if the work's any good, you're letting some stuff out of the bag, even if it's in careful fictional disguise, right? You know, you could ask David, you know, so what were the reactions of friends of his or relatives of his to seeing this piece of writing? And it's complicated. So of course you do think about who might read it. But the main way that I think about the audience is that my Hippocratic oath of writing is never confuse the reader. Take good care of the reader. Make it clear what the emotional stakes of the story are and where we are and what we're dealing with. And part of the reason that I emphasize that is because I think in this era of screen addiction and kind of frantic distraction, writers, oftentimes young writers, are so they're competing with these frantic visual media. And so they just sort of try to immerse the reader immediately in all these intense sensual details and kind of throw everything but the kitchen sink at the reader. And the reader's oftentimes terribly confused by that and just disoriented. So my credo as a writer is, you know, my job is really to build a reliable psychological and emotional ramp to the moments that really matter, and then slow down as much as I can in the midst of those moments.
David, where does technique fit into all of this? You know, the nuts and bolts, the grammar, the sentence structure, the point of view. Where does all of that fit into the motivation?
Well, that's the toolbox. That's the craft. And the craft of writing is what Writers at Work is all about. We are teachers of craft, and we're an independent organization. We're all volunteers. And we just take it as our job that we are trying to teach craft on a very high level. I wanted to say one thing in response to your quote from Terry Tempest Williams, that I have never envisioned a piece of writing. I think about an incident that happened in my past, in my youth, and I think, I need to write that up. And I sit down at the computer, and there's a blank page in front of me, and it has never happened that it comes out the way I had envisioned it. It is always different. There is something that creeps in there from the subconscious that directs things, and it's an odd, exhilarating, wonderful experience. But it's also frightening. You know, writers talk about the dread of the blank page, and that's it.
Do you feel that dread, Steve Almond? How do you get over it?
You don't get over it. You manage it.
Nobody
does, and people will sometimes think because, you know, if you're a published author, the trick to that whole thing, as David knows, is you've edited all your bad decisions, all your ambivalence, all your fear, all your evasions. Those have been edited out. That's why you're published. But every writer goes through their first draft and second and third and fourth draft, and I hate writing. I mean, it for me to have to bear down and concentrate and really just stare at the page and imagine my way into a character's life or, you know, revisit something from my own life that's difficult and complicated, that's no fun. That's not my idea of a day at the park. But the alternative is I feel like that stuff lives inside me and sort of festers. And, you know, so I sort of feel like I don't really have a choice in the matter. I can either be honest about this stuff in the one way that I know how to tell stories effectively. I'm not a good musician or a visual artist or anything else. This is what I have, what I've been given, the language. And that's how I have to go about trying to, you know, write about the stuff that matters to me. That's really all I do when people say, well, what should I be writing about? And I always say to them, well, what can't you get rid of by other means? What stays there? What lingers?
Yeah.
And that in the end is the stuff you wind up writing about. There's a funny quote from Kurt Vonnegut, who was a writer I, you know, worshipped and read when I was in high school and college and reread still. And somebody asked him at the end of his life, well, what's your essential topic, Kurt Vonnegut? This is just about 6 months before he died. And he looked at the audience and he said, I write again and again about my family. And this was a shocking answer, Jennifer, because if you've read Kurt Vonnegut, you would expect him to say something lofty, like, I write about the fate of the species, or I write about our morality and our moral failings, or the chaos of war. But really, what he was saying is, you write about, in whatever disguise, the people who you love and have tried to love and who you love, you know, feel the most deeply about, you're writing about them for the rest of your lives.
Hmm.
You know, and that's not easy stuff to do.
You are working with aspiring writers all the time. You give many, many workshops and, you know, influence hundreds of students. What are the common mistakes that you find people making in their writing consistently? I mean, are there patterns?
Yeah, there absolutely are. The first thing, as I mentioned, is that out of an insecurity about whether the story they have to tell is really worth telling, and also in some sense because they don't know the story they want to tell yet or they're not ready to face it, young writers, I don't mean young chronologically, but early in their career, tend to sort of just try to immerse the reader in scene immediately. And they're also told over and over again, well, you're a creative writer now, write in scene, show, don't tell.
Mm.
And that kind of dogma causes people to not really set up a narrator, the person who guides the reader into the story. If you read any of the literature from the 19th century or early 20th century, there's always this wonderful entity known as the narrator who guides the reader through and makes sure they're never confused. Sometimes the story will swoop into a more subjective mode, but we always have this we always have this narrator who's guiding us through the action. I think people tend to overwrite because they want the reader to feel emotion, and so they assert it rather than dramatizing it. I see that all the time. They write because they want to sound intelligent. I think most of the mistakes that writers make early in their career are the mistakes I made. They're mistakes that come from your insecurity about whether what you have to say is worth saying and whether the story you want to tell is worth telling.
David, are those the mistakes you see?
Oh, yes. Every writer has to go through this process. I had someone tell me that it takes 10 years to make a writer. I mean, you can get a medical degree in 7 years. But I think it's true that it's the people who are willing to stay with it and open their minds and take correction and take comment and even seek out criticism that will really get through to the point where they can produce publishable material.
Hmm.
And it doesn't even have to be publishable as long as they're satisfied and they can satisfy a reader.
Steve Almond, our time is short, but do I dare ask you what advice you give to those aspiring novelists out there?
Well, it's the same thing David said, really. This is a marathon. It's not a sprint, you know? And the people who end up persisting as writers are the ones who are able to recognize that they need to get better and to look at the work of the people around them, usually at their same level, and compassionately explain when they're making good decisions as a writer and when they're making less good decisions, because that's how you learn to get better. It sounds counterintuitive, but in my workshops, I always emphasize, you'll get better as a critic before you get better as a writer, because you have to develop this capacity, the critical faculty, which allows you to judge your decisions without giving in to the opera of self-doubt. That's just how it works, and that's the only way that people get better. It's not glamorous, but that's really how it works.
Mm. Steve Almond, he is the author of 10 books, including Candy Freak and God Bless America, and his article, Why Therapy is on the Wane and Writing Workshops are on the Rise, was published in the May 23rd edition of the New York Times Magazine. He joined us from the studios of WGBH in Boston. And Steve Almond, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
And David Tippetts, a board member of Writers at Work. And the Writers at Work conference, the 27th annual, will be held in Alta, Utah from June 6th to June 10th. And David, I understand there still are spots available there?
Yes, there are still spots available in Steve's workshop. A couple of them are full, but we still have a lot of places left.
Terrific. More details on the website, writersatwork.org, or of course go to kcpw.org for more information. And David, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up, surveying the Salt Lake City Cemetery, but first a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Cemeteries are peaceful sites that encourage memories and contemplation, but these final resting places also link us to our collective past. The Salt Lake City Cemetery is chock full of prophets, politicians, and pioneers, people who shaped Utah's history. And today on the program, we're learning more about the saints and sinners buried in the Salt Lake City Cemetery. And joining us is Linda Hilton. She is a church liaison, a resource coordinator, project director for the Coalition of Religious Communities at Crossroads Urban Center. But she's here today because she researched and she wrote something called The Famous and Infamous, A Guide to the Salt Lake City Cemetery. And Linda Hilton, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for letting me be here.
What are your stories about the Salt Lake City Cemetery? Have you searched for Emo's grave or wondered where Brigham Young is buried? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Linda, you're so well known for your work in the social services. and when I called you to ask for this interview, I can understand your concern. You know, you wanted a journalistic answer, but really I was curious about your interest in cemeteries and specifically the Salt Lake City Cemetery. What got you interested in compiling this map of prominent Utahns buried at the city cemetery?
Well, it started back when I had a member of the family buried there, and at the time, one of the LDS church presidents had just died, and this family member was buried near the church president, and when I would go up to the gravesite, people would stop and say, well, where is this person buried? And I finally went to find out and gave the answer, and then they'd say, well, where's this person buried and who else is here? I went down to the cemetery office and said, haven't you got a guide to this cemetery? And they handed me a piece of paper with 19 white male Mormons on it and one woman who was the mother of one of those men. And being the feminist that I am and the interfaith worker that I am, I said, there has to be more to the cemetery than just these men. Mm. So I started looking for women and fun stories. I grew up in the Avenues, so I knew about Emo. And of course, Emo's grave had to be part of that. And it just sort of went from there.
Okay, well, before we go any further, what is Emo's grave? For those who don't know.
Well, Emo's grave is not really Emo's grave. It is the gravesite of a man named Jacob Moritz, who actually was a beer brewer. You can still see the remains of his company. The Anniversary Inn is in that building on the curve of 4th South to 5th South on about 10th East. But he was Jewish. He was cremated and buried in an urn. And there were some, there was a Hebrew word on the urn, and people thought it looked like the word emo. Mm. And then they started making up all of these stories. One that is my favorite from the Ward House down on 4th Avenue was that if you didn't know if the girl that you were going to marry was the right one, you took her over to the cemetery, and if she made it all the way to Emo's grave with you, she was meant to be your wife. There's all kinds of other stories about full moons and walking around with lit matches, and he'll appear and talk to you. So many urban legends.
Many urban legends. We're talking about the Salt Lake City Cemetery with Linda Hilton. She is the compiler, the researcher, the writer behind the famous and infamous A Guide to the Salt Lake City Cemetery. And if you've got stories about the city cemetery, feel free to join us. 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Describe the cemetery physically for us. I mean, it's a massive place. It's got beautiful views.
It does, and it is really extensive. It starts at 4th Avenue. It goes up to 11th Avenue, the main part of the cemetery. But then there are three separate little cemeteries connected to it on the other side of 11th Avenue on the north side. There are places that have been put aside for the Jewish faithful. There are several veterans plots. Most people know the one up towards 11th Avenue where a lot of the World War II Vietnam people are buried. But there is a part of the cemetery that's set aside for people that fought in the Mexican-American War, another place for the Spanish-American War. There's even a monument there to people who died in the Civil War.
One interesting fact I read about the cemetery is that it's the largest city-operated cemetery in the U.S. Do you know how many people are buried there? And is it near capacity?
There are over 100,000 people. I can't remember the exact number. It is getting close to capacity. They are asking families who have, you know, extra plots if they want to sell them or give them up. But yes, it is getting close to capacity. Just in the northeast corner is about all that's left.
I understand the first burial was in 1847. So when did the city fathers decide this should be the site for the city cemetery? Do you know?
It was actually Brigham Young. And a lot of people think that Brigham Young is buried in the Salt Lake City Cemetery, and he's not. He's buried in his own private cemetery on First Avenue between State Street and A Street. And he buried a lot of his family there, and at one point the city council said, you've got too many people at that lot, you need to start burying the rest of your family somewhere else. And there was no city cemetery. His friend was George Wallace, and he was talking to George Wallace, and George said, well, there's a peaceful hillside where I've buried my daughter and my son. And he took Brigham Young up there, and Brigham Young said, this is going to be the Salt Lake City Cemetery, and put aside all of that land way back in the 1840s. Yeah, he put that aside for the city cemetery. And the first recorded burials, even though they were there before the cemetery was started, are George Wallace's daughter and son.
You mentioned Brigham Young, not buried at the city cemetery, but many other LDS prophets are.
They are. Quite a few of them, the majority of them, are buried there, as are a lot of people in Brigham Young's family. There are also a lot of prominent people who served in the Relief Society, the First Presidency, who are there. There's also a huge monument sort of to the memory of the martyrdom of Hiram Smith that his relatives built when they got out here, because, of course, he's not buried here, but they wanted him to be remembered.
Going from saints to sinners, you record that the Sundance Kid is buried in the city cemetery.
The purported Sundance Kid. And if you look at a lot of research, when you go on a bus tour around the city or something, they'll say that it's the Sundance Kid. It actually probably is not the Sundance Kid, but somebody who rode with the gang. He did know a lot about what Butch Cassidy was up to, and he did have a lot of stories that only somebody, you know, directly riding with the Sundance Kid could know. But they have shown now that probably he's not the Sundance Kid, just a good, faithful member of the gang.
Talk about some of the prominent politicians who were buried in the city cemetery. We've got a lot of governors.
We do have a lot of governors. Simon Bamberger was one of the first Jewish governors in the nation. He was, of course, the only Jewish governor that we have. He's buried in one of the two Jewish portions of the cemetery. We have one that named Cutler. He ended up committing suicide. That's an interesting story. And a lot that people will remember, Governor Ma, people like that. Mm-hmm. There are also a lot of mayors from Salt Lake City's first mayor to a mayor that people don't know a lot about named Louis Marcus. He had a vision in the 30s that the only way that Salt Lake was going to survive was on water. And he created the first water district and the Deer Creek Reservoir Project so that future water needs of Salt Lake would be met. He was quite a visionary.
We're speaking with Linda Hilton. She compiled research and wrote a map of the city cemetery called The Famous and Infamous, A Guide to the City Cemetery. And you can join us if you like. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. You also have mentioned some people who may not be as prominent as the politicians, but still made an impact on our culture here. I'm thinking of the artist Alice Merrill Horn.
Yes, Alice Merrill Horn was a very influential person in Utah history and also in the nation. She had a vision to promote artists in the West and brought a lot of their art to Salt Lake for shows. But she also started what became the Utah Arts Foundation. But it was the first of its kind in the country, actually a government agency that supported the arts, particularly visual arts. And we have her to thank for that. We also have Lucy Walcott.
Mm-hmm.
No, not Walcott. Anyway, we have the first woman's dean of the University of Utah. We have other founders of women's programs and some of the first women doctors who were in the nation and actually in Utah. And Utah actually has a very interesting political first in that we had the first woman elected to a state legislature, a senator, Martha Hughes Cannon. And she actually ran against her husband and his friends and won. But that was the first year that women had the right to vote, and they were so excited that they had a candidate, a female to vote for, that they voted her in.
Over her husband.
Over her husband.
And they are both buried in the city cemetery.
Right, her husband and all the wives. She was the seventh, but she started the Utah Health Department. She was a doctor, and she learned about all kinds of things like diseases being spread from people not washing hands and not properly storing meat. So we have her to thank for the beginnings of all of that.
One of the men who really shaped the way the city looks is Truman Angel, an architect. He's also buried at the city cemetery.
He is. He is, and he has a very interesting grave site. There are some interesting monuments up there. He just has a very interesting headstone, which you would have to go and see. It's hard to describe. Some others that are interesting, there's a man named Beasley, and he was a composer. There's actually a stanza of a hymn that he wrote written out on his headstone. I forget the name of the hymn, but I did go look it up. And
let us oft speak kind words is what you've written here.
There you go. Right, and the man who did the Siegel Monument down at the Temple Square is there, and the Handcart Monument, and there are pictures of those actually engraved on the gravestones.
Oh, interesting, mm-hmm. Interesting. You also have noted that the Christmas Box Angel was inspired, I guess, by one of the headstones at the city cemetery?
You know, I really don't know the whole story about what brought Richard Paul Evans to write the book. There is some history there where there was a flood in the cemetery, so it has a loose historical basis. But the monument is up there, and it's really one of the most touching places in the cemetery. It has a little poem on the back, but it's a place where people who can go who've lost children, especially like miscarried or in the early days, you know, you didn't bury your children. They just sort of took them away. And every time I've been up there, there are little shoes and pictures and toys and letters from parents to their children that they've never met and never seen. And it's really very, very touching. A lot of white flowers, because there is a thing in the book where you bring a white flower.
Mm.
Yeah.
How often do you go to the cemetery these days?
I don't go there a lot, but I still do some tours for groups. And every once in a while, I hear about something new that I go and try to find. My next trip is going to be to find a burial that of some Native American remains from the Natural History Museum that they actually have put there in the upper part, and I've not seen that area. So I'm looking forward to going and finding that.
And if someone is searching for a family member like you were, they may not be related to a prophet or whatever. How do you find a relative who's buried in the cemetery?
There is a house by 4th Avenue and N Street. It's the sexton of the cemetery, and they have all the records. Or you can even go online and subscribe to some things like findagrave.com that'll tell you where anybody in your family's buried pretty much anywhere.
And it doesn't sound like you're afraid of cemeteries. You find them as a place of inspiration and stories.
In the daylight.
In the daylight.
Don't take me there after dark. I'm a chicken.
Linda Hilton. She is the author of The Map, the famous and infamous, a guide to the Salt Lake City Cemetery. And you can find that in local bookstores. And Linda, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Lauren Hendrickson. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Tomorrow, coming up, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. Hope you'll join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.